From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll examine the case against Crystal Kaiser, who killed a man who was allegedly trafficking her when she was a teen.
The sooner that we realize that survivorhood looks like very many different things, the easier it'll be to figure out what solutions we actually need to end gender-based violence.
Then we'll hear reactions to the proposed relocation of the Line 5 pipeline. Plus, we'll explore the history of Les Petits Bonbons, a group of radical gay activists from Milwaukee.
The group is really a bit of an enigma. I mean, they really started as, you know, just a group of disaffected young activists who were really looking to reinvent the world.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. Today, we'll learn about Les Petits Bonbons.
These were seven boys from Milwaukee who skyrocketed to international celebrity status, hobnobbed with people like David Bowie and Iggy Pop and Lou Reed.
That story is coming up later in the show. But we'll start with the story of a local woman named Crystal Kaiser. Her case gained national attention in 2018 when she was charged with killing her suspected trafficker when she was 17 years old. It was a story that brought renewed attention to child trafficking and spurred conversations and debates about survivorhood and self-defense. After years of back and forth with Kenosha courts and the state, Kaiser accepted a plea deal on reduced charges of reckless homicide last month. Santara Matthews is a co-founding member of the Crystal Kaiser Defense Committee, and she joins Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez to talk about this case and how she got involved.
I was teaching in Milwaukee at the time and came across a headline that said that there was a young black girl who was a teenager who, and this is what the paper alleged, that she had shot and killed an older man and an older white man in Kenosha, Wisconsin. Somebody who was in Illinois actually reached out to some organizers in Milwaukee and said, hey, like, I want you all to, like, hear this story. Like, there's this young girl and there's more to the story than what's being told. And she acted in self-defense. And because of this self-defense, the man died. Other friends had organized around a young black girl named Brisha Meadows and how people had gotten involved in her story. She was a youth who killed her father in an act of self-defense. And the reporting around that story was very similar. It was just like young teen kills dad. And organizers, their ears perked up and they were like, people don't just kill their parents. Mm-hmm. Like, there's more to this story. And what they did was they looked into it, connected with her family, and started a defense team. So I learned from that story to, like, okay, there's more to Crystal's story. And that's how I developed relationships with her family, with her, to find out more. And learning through lots of other deeper reporting that the Washington Post had done that Crystal was being groomed by this man named Randy Villar. And grooming is the process of getting people comfortable with things that push the boundary. And by that, I mean, like, sexual abuse, which I guess is not just pushing the boundary. It's, like, harm and violence. What ended up happening as a result of this is she needed to act in self-defense. Our defense committee formed. And we were able to rally support from across the city of Milwaukee, the state of Wisconsin, Kenosha, and across the nation. Mm-hmm. We started a petition that has over a million, close to 2 million signatures at this point, saying that people affirm that Crystal is a survivor of gender-based violence, specifically trafficking, and that she deserves healing instead of more punishment in the form of prison.
So the thing with Crystal's story, I remember when it first got out there and you brought up Risha, and the thing is that it wasn't like the nation hadn't wrestled with what survivorhood looked like. I mean, Santoya Brown's story went viral. And I think around that same time, she was commuted for a life sentence after she killed her trafficker or killed a trafficker. I'm curious with you and, like, all of the work that you've done and coming into this, like, what do we still have to learn about survivorhood, specifically when it comes to the ideas of what is self-defense and who it's allowed to?
That's the question. I think that there's this mainstream idea that survivors are going to be easily identifiable, that it's just like this visible, very clear situation of violence was happening and the person asked them to stop and that no wasn't honored. But survivorhood sometimes looks like having to fight back and making a non-choice in killing somebody. Survivorhood looks like sometimes staying in a relationship because the person who's harming you is paying for your bills, your housing, your healthcare is attached to it. Survivorhood looks like dying because the person who is abusing you actually pushes it to the end and kills you. It looks like fighting back. It looks like asking for help again and again and not hearing. So I think that the sooner that we realize that survivorhood looks like very many different things, the easier it'll be to figure out like what solutions we actually need to end gender-based violence. Mm-hmm.
I can hear some people thinking, and I've seen the argument made that, well, you know, in some of these cases, these men were incapacitated or sleeping, which maybe loses sight of the fact of these were grown men with girls, smaller girls. And I guess I would just pose that to you, like, what is being missed in the conversation when people do frame it as, well, the people who were murdered or these traffickers were incapacitated?
We have to understand that even just in physical size, when we hear stories about that, where there may be somebody who was incapacitated or sleeping, that young person, that smaller person is trying to navigate and the abuse that even though that person is incapacitated doesn't mean that they're still not a significant threat. I mean, there's like experts that will say like there's a pattern of young people fighting back when somebody is incapacitated because that's when the power, just in that physical power in that situation, just is what it is.
I did want to get to which you had touched on already, was how her story was reported. And from the beginning, it was really intense. The details were intense. She was still a child at this point. What did you see and what are the challenges to getting Crystal's story right through the media and what were they?
What's really hard is that when somebody is pretrial, meaning that they've been charged with certain crimes but have not been convicted of them, is that they still need to go in front of a court of law to present their case. And so anything that they say to the media really publicly can and will be used against them, because when people go to trial, it's the side of the defense that is presenting their case. And so even when survivors want to tell their story so badly, they have to do it in like very careful ways because they're showing their hand. What they say may be thrown against them.
The Washington Post piece was so revealing, and it felt like it did a lot to bring attention to Crystal's case and framing survivorhood in maybe a more constructive way or a more thoughtful, thorough way than some of the original crime reporting that was first available through police reports. But even that had a backlash of sorts, you told me.
Yeah, I mean, the story garnered so much attention. That is how Cyntoia Brown, as you had mentioned, was being released from custody at that time, and she was able to amplify and uplift Crystal's story. We believe that piece like helped gain so much attention that it helped garner lots and lots of people really ready to rally behind her. But the offside of that is the district attorney gets to see every piece of that story and use that against her again. It's just another case of when people try to take their power back. It's really hard because there's this entity right now, the district attorney, that just needs to win his case.
And we'll get to Gravely here in a second, which I think it's really important to understand him and a bit of his background when it comes to this case. What was Crystal's relationship with the state? How would she come in contact with them throughout some of the issues with housing and just trying to find a stable place, both her and her family? And how did the state react to her at all those touch points along the way?
I can speak to one specific touch point. This is all mentioned in the Washington Post article. They were able to get police reports from the Kenosha Police Department. And so what happened in February of 2018, there was another young girl who made a call to the Kenosha Police Department asking for support. She actually called from Valar's house, and she was alleging that she was in severe danger and she needed support. It wasn't until days later that the Kenosha Police Department was able to actually enter and search Valar's property, where they confiscated child pornography. And of those pictures was Crystal. And charges were never entered, and those files weren't given to the Kenosha County District Attorney for 3 months. And still, even after that point, there weren't any charges entered. So I think that's a clear example of the state having a picture of Crystal as a child and not doing anything about it.
Now seems like a really important time to get into who some of these other people are that are involved in Crystal's case and have been involved, Randy Valar and DA Mike Gravely. So what are their backgrounds and kind of why are they important when it comes to Crystal's story?
Yeah, I think that Randy Valar, unfortunately, the only parts of his life that I know are that he had a track record of harming young Black women and girls. And then in terms of the Kenosha County DA, prior to being district attorney for Kenosha County, had been in charge of prosecuting sexual violence crimes. Like, he was supposedly this advocate for survivors of sexual violence.
When it comes to Crystal's case, too, it was the first time that affirmative defense was invoked in the state. Can you just share a little bit about what that means and why it was applied to her case?
So I am not an attorney. So, like, my layman's understanding is that it was a law that said that survivors of human trafficking could not be charged and punished for anything that had to do with being trafficked. Crystal, like you had mentioned, would have been the first to ever be able to use the affirmative defense. And her team fought very hard to make sure that she would be able to. The district attorney didn't want her to be able to use this, even though a judge had ruled in her favor. And it kept going to up in the ranks of appeals, up until where the Wisconsin Supreme Court said, "You'll have to fact check me on this," but they ruled saying that, like, even in situations of death, that the affirmative defense could be used. And so it would have been monumental, because it goes back to what we were talking about earlier, how seeing that there's a spectrum of survivorhood from not making it, not surviving, all the way to having to make that non-choice of it's either me or you.
The other part of this for me that doesn't just apply to Crystal, but I'm thinking of, like, all survivors and people who are deeply traumatized or have faced incredible violence throughout their life, throughout their young lives, is the need for mental health support and treatment. And a question that I have is, what does trauma-informed care look like for survivors specifically?
I'll start off by saying nobody enters these situations by choice. Young people aren't saying, I really would love to ruin the rest of my life. People are set up with a lot of non-choices, like I keep saying. So for me, what I think, understand trauma-informed care is making sure that we prevent it, making sure that people have, like you had said, adequate health care, including mental health care, but also housing stability, a basic living income. Being able to have, like, joy in people's life is huge. Having a safe space, meaning safe from harm and the threats of violence. Like, that is trauma-informed, like, as well. Just making sure that people have what they need to live dignified lives.
And then bringing it back to Crystal's case, what should people take away from her story, and where do we go from here?
Yeah, people should take away that she is a survivor. She is a survivor who is deserving of our care and our support, and that this fight is not done. That just because we're at or she's at where she is with her case, that it means that we're going to let her just disappear into the prison system. We're absolutely not. She has a team that is ready to keep fighting to make sure that she's home and that she can heal, and that this can just be, this part of her life, this chapter can be over. But her story isn't done.
Santera Matthews is a co-founding member of the Crystal Kaiser Defense Committee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez. WUWM has a new politics podcast called Swing State of the Union. It explores why Wisconsin is a deeply purple state and why it's so important in this election year. New episodes drop every Wednesday leading up to the Republican National Convention. You can find it wherever you like to listen to podcasts. Coming up, we'll hear reactions from a meeting last week about the proposal to relocate the Line 5 pipeline in northern Wisconsin. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Last week, more than 100 people gathered in northern Wisconsin to weigh in on a proposal to reroute the Line 5 pipeline. Enbridge operates Line 5, some of which is on tribal land. The Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa sued to have the pipeline removed from tribal land. Now Enbridge is proposing relocating the line. WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz attended the hearings. There she met Devin Young Cuppery, a filmmaker and community organizer.
I really first got involved with that project hearing the tribal chair at the time of the Bad River Band speak. Chair Mike Wiggins was speaking about the threats of this proposed iron mine in the Pinoki Hills to the Bad River people, and I was really shaken hearing about how the headwaters of that watershed could turn into sulfuric acid and drain into their vast wild rice beds on Lake Superior. And I actually pitched that film topic to 371 Productions, and we got it funded. And it was a really meaningful experience working on that film. As the producer, I got to know many people, the Bad River Band, local residents in the area on multiple sides of the issue.
Talk a little bit more about that. What sticks with you? Because I'm guessing a lot does.
You know, the people I met have so much love for this place, for the water, for Lake Superior, for the rivers. And the people who live here because they love it. And the Bad River Band, this has been their homeland since time immemorial, and they can't just find another home if their land is polluted. One of the interviews that really stuck with me, we interviewed Philomena Quebec, a Bad River tribal member, and she talked about how just some of her personal experiences, like deeply troubling personal experiences, were closely related to this environmental exploitation. And without going into too much detail, I cried at the interview and was really deeply shaken.
So your work has continued?
Since those days, I've continued work in both environmental advocacy and filmmaking, now living in the Twin Cities. And regarding what's happening right now with this proposed Line 5 pipeline, I had followed the Line 3 pipeline permitting process and construction. I followed the impacts of construction. And so I'm deeply concerned, based on Enbridge's record in Minnesota, about what could happen here. Enbridge violated multiple permits. They illegally released hundreds of millions of gallons of Minnesota's groundwater. They made this request for 5 billion gallons of water to pull that from the ground in a drought. And this area here is, you could say, even more water rich. And all the waters that this proposed reroute crosses, almost all of them flow into the Bad River Band's wild rice beds. And Bridge is proposing to cross over 100 streams and rivers that all flow into this incredibly special, outstanding ecosystem. Sturgeon, walleye, bass, just all at risk here in the homelands of the Bad River Band.
Line 5 already has coursed through the reservation.
Yeah, the pipeline had originally been laid on the Bad River Reservation in the 50s without the consent of the Bad River Band. And last year, a federal judge ruled that Enbridge has been in trespass of the Bad River Band for a decade. So Enbridge has been illegally operating that pipeline on the res for a decade. And now their proposed reroute would not solve the problem. It would not reduce the risk. And the band has made it clear they do not support the reroute either. And in fact, ultimately may put them at more risk.
Why is it then today the Army Corps is holding this hearing? What is the specific point they're looking at?
Sure. So the Army Corps hearing today, they are assessing specific crossings that pertain to navigable waters of the U.S. The Bad River Band and advocates have requested to the Army Corps of Engineers to expand to a full environmental impact statement, and in fact, a full environmental impact statement of the whole Line 5. This is a 70-year-old pipeline operating 20 years past its engineered life expectancy, and it's also at the brink of rupturing under the Straits of Mackinac into Lake Michigan and Lake Huron. And I grew up on Lake Michigan in Milwaukee, and yeah, it's really frightening and deeply painful to think that this is what's at risk every day with this pipeline right now.
So Devin, what have you seen, because you've been monitoring, filming, and writing about this issue?
You know, at this hearing today, so many of the people here are local residents, Bad River Band tribal members, people who have so much at stake with this proposed project. There are also allies across the region who have come to share their experience. For example, seeing the damage that Enbridge has done in Minnesota with the Line 3 pipeline construction. So it really feels like people are coming together in new ways, people sharing their experiences in different parts of the region with the same problem.
In observing this process over the course of time, what gives you hope in this process, and what most concerns you about the process?
What gives me hope, you know, with the project I worked on, the film project about this proposed mine in the Pinoki Hills of northern Wisconsin, the people who were speaking up and resisting that did not necessarily think that the process was in their favor, but they believed that their voices mattered. They believed that this place is worth protecting, and because of that, they ended up winning, and that mining company withdrew its plans. So, you know, the people give me hope. The people here that I have gotten to know, the spirit of love and dedication to this place they call home.
You really are chronicling environmental history and the future.
Yeah, I think what I've learned in the course of documenting these stories of people protecting their homes is it matters to speak from your heart. People matter, and it matters to respect the original peoples of this land. That is something I've been really dedicated to, following the leadership of Bad River tribal members and the Anishinaabe people. people in this region, the Dakota people in the Twin Cities, that's really a guiding principle for me.
Support for environmental reporting is provided in part by Brico Fund.
Devin Young-Cuppery is a Milwaukee native and filmmaker. She spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz. Line 5 is operated by Enbridge, which is a financial supporter of WUWM. Coming up in honor of Pride Month, we're exploring the history of Les Petits Bonbons, a group of radical gay activists founded right here in Milwaukee. That's next on Lake Effect. On 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. For many, June has become synonymous with Pride Month. The annual celebration is an opportunity to reflect on the history of the LGBTQ+ community and how it continues to impact our culture. In this month's Milwaukee Magazine, historian Michael Takash explores a little-known group called Les Petits Bonbons. The group formed in the early 1970s in Milwaukee, and its impact on Hollywood's glitter rock scene has gone down in history. Takash joins me to explain more. Michael, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Yes, thanks for having us.
So this is a kind of big question, which, you know, we'll unpack throughout this conversation. But who were Les Petits Bonbons?
The group is really a bit of an enigma. I mean, they really started as, you know, just a group of disaffected young activists who were really looking to reinvent the world. They really thought that on this dawn of gay liberation, in the first few years following the Stonewall Uprising, that, you know, a revolution was coming and that they would be the bringers of change, whether it be through direct activism or through this new form of art, sex, and expression that they were hoping to create for the world. The group was born out of the gay liberation movement in Milwaukee, centered around UW-Milwaukee, where Barbara Gibson, a student faculty advisor, had stepped forward to found the first gay rights group at UWM, which was known initially as the Homosexual Freedom League. Within a few weeks, that group renamed itself the Gay Liberation Organization, and a splinter group broke off that was known as Gay Liberation Front. The idea was that the GLO was much more interested in having social events and having kind of togetherness and unity. And the GLF was more interested in marching in the streets, breaking windows, and really drawing attention to themselves in a way that had never been done before. So some of the members of these new, different and certainly disparately minded groups came together in other forms, one of which was the Radical Queens, which was a group that came together. And this, again, was a very defiant, very unapologetic, very, I think we would today call them queer first, activists who really sought to, again, challenge the status quo, really draw attention to the burgeoning gay rights movement, really make people think and question and even fear, because, in their words, gay people had been scared long enough, and now it was time for the rest of the world to be scared of gay people. The idea of Les Petits Bonbons was born as a stage show for these radical queens, who again were a derivative of those earlier gay liberation groups. Mm-hmm. Although the show was never produced, a photo shoot was. And this photo shoot by the legendary Milwaukee photographer Francis Ford really put the bonbons on the map. It really made them look like they were someone, that they were famous, that they were celebrities. And at this point, they had not yet really done much of anything.
Now, it seems like a lot of at least the origins of this group, but also kind of what continued to be one of their most known assets was their look. What did this group really look like?
So it's interesting because this early 70s window of time is a real intersection of the gay liberation movement and the glam rock movement. And the Bon Bons kind of synthesized those two into a really confrontational look, some of whom incorporated what they called scare drag or gender fluid costumery, and others did no drag at all. So it was really quite of a spectrum, quite a diversity of people who looked very different, acted very different, and lived very differently, all within this same traveling circus effect. One famous member of this group was Chucky Betts, who was very into self-ornamentation. He really wanted to be seen by people, and he really wanted people to notice him. So some of his outfits were quite shocking. One time he entered a Halloween costume contest after dyeing himself green in a bathtub full of red dye and wearing high heels, platform wedges that had goldfish inside of them. He was famously seen on the front page of the Milwaukee Journal wearing ostrich feathers as eyelashes, kind of a 1920s classic Art Deco look, which resulted in him being photographed, identified, and put on the front page of the Milwaukee Journal. And for many of that generation, it was the first time they'd ever seen a gay person anywhere. They didn't even know they existed in Milwaukee. They didn't even know there were people like themselves in town. They maybe knew that they existed in New York or San Francisco, but not here in Milwaukee. And it was really a siren call for other people to come out and be seen and live their life and be their truth. And Chucky was quite good at that. But other members of the group did not do drag at all. I mean, they just, you know, kind of had this really hip, very now, very sophisticated, but very trendy glam rock look. I think that they described it as kind of an acid trip meets Alice in Wonderland that shopped at a thrift store. I mean, it was really grassroots, but ultra cutting edge. And it really defined the era. I think that what's most telling is that, you know, their look was so captivating to photographers that not only did they appear in Francis Ford's photo shoot after they relocated to California, they appeared in music and fashion magazines all over the world. And in fact, a famous photo that was taken in early 1973 of the two main Bon Bons outside of Rodney Bingenheimer's English Disco was circulated worldwide by UPI and caused an international fashion sensation. I mean, they overnight were famous simply for being famous.
You mentioned, you know, when one of them was on the cover of a newspaper here in Milwaukee, this was something that was in and of itself pretty radical at the time. This was a very Milwaukee movement. Milwaukee and maybe Cudahy, we should add into that, Milwaukee area. How would you describe their cultural impact specifically here in Milwaukee?
Well, you have to keep in mind that the majority of this group, of which there were essentially 7 to 8 members, most of these were just teenagers from South Milwaukee and Cudahy. And as somebody who grew up on the South Shore, that's what I found most fascinating about this story. These weren't people who grew up in a very liberal, intellectual, very artistic background. I mean, these were people who grew up with parents who worked very blue collar manufacturing jobs, the very traditional Milwaukee jobs. And somehow they found their calling and they found each other. And they really shattered the status quo in not only Milwaukee, but later Los Angeles and the American music scene. These were 7 boys from Milwaukee who skyrocketed to international celebrity status, hobnobbed with people like David Bowie and Iggy Pop and Lou Reed, people from Andy Warhol's factory, and then just kind of moved on with their lives. One thing I really think is important about this story is how the story unfolded. And the fact that, you know, not only are most people not aware of this, you know, glam rock gay liberation group, but the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project was not fully aware of them either. So we had heard their name in passing. We had heard of some of the names of the members. We knew that there was a thing called the Bon Bons, but we didn't really understand what it was or when it was or how big of a deal it was until Chucky Betts passed away last fall. And his family willed his photo collection to the History Project. Now, this is really an important part of the story because typically when an LGBTQ elder dies, his family, his survivors, have no idea what to do with those materials. It could be photos, it could be memorabilia, and it is extremely rare that a family member will take the time to seek out someone to be the beneficiary of that history. And the challenge that we have is so much of that history has already been lost. The AIDS crisis erased nearly an entire generation of people and took their history and their lived experiences with them. And I can only be grateful to the Betts family for sharing his wealth of photos with us, because it is through that process that we uncovered this secret history of the Bon-Bons and this fabulous story about seven young men who somehow created themselves as the first social influencers and the first self-made celebrities.
What do you think is the lasting legacy of their movement?
There's quite a bit to that question. I think that the first one is that as we look at what Pride Month looks like today, and then we look at these pioneers, these people who were truly the first to stand up and be willing to be seen and be willing to sacrifice everything and be willing to fight for what they believed in, I think that their legacy is to question if we've gotten too comfortable, if we've gotten too complacent, if we've settled back into that world that they were born into, where everything was just the way it was and there was no questioning or changing it. Their legacy is one of accountability to drive action, to constantly invent a better future, and to really drive thought, looking at the lives that they led. I think we have an opportunity and an obligation as a community to constantly fight for something better and to not worry about making people comfortable, not making people feel safe with us, not making people feel that we'll settle for tolerance. We're not here just to be tolerated. We're here to be equal. You know, they didn't want to be pretty. They didn't want to be straight, and they didn't necessarily want to be accepted, but they did want to be seen. They wanted to be known, and they wanted people to know that they were not going to change to make people happy, safe, or comfortable with them. They were here to disrupt society and to create a new society and as a result. And I think that that's something that, you know, has gotten a little bit lost in recent years. Having spoken to some of the surviving Bon-Bons, they truly believed their movement was going to change the world. And, it's up to us to keep that change in motion.
For sure. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
Michael Takash is a historian and chair of the Wisconsin LGBTQ History Project. His article on Les Petits Bonbons is featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine.
Didn't know what time it was, the lights were low, oh, oh. I leaned back on my radio, oh, oh. Some cat was laying down some rock and roll, not a soul said. And the loud sound, it seemed to fade, came back like a slow voice on a wave of fate. That weren't no DJ, that was hazy cosmic time. There's a starman waiting in the sky. He'd like to come and meet us, but he thinks.
Swimming weather has arrived, and there's a program working to help address lifeguard shortages during this swimming season. The Aquatics Ambassadors Program helps to recruit lifeguards and promotes water safety in Milwaukee County through a partnership with the Milwaukee Parks Foundation and Milwaukee County Parks. Mother and son Ray Johnson and Elijah Moore are two aquatics ambassadors who recently learned how to swim. They join Lake Effect's Excret Nunez, along with Milwaukee Parks Foundation's Executive Director, Rebecca Stoner, to talk about the program.
When I started in this role at the Milwaukee Parks Foundation, one of the first things I did was connect with as many people as possible to hear hey, what do you love about your parks? What challenges are you seeing in your parks? And consistently this same thing kept coming up again and again. People were saying, I miss my pool. I used to swim in such and such pool in such and such park, and it's closed, and I wish there were more pools, and why aren't there pools in my neighborhood? And it was a very obvious disparity to where pools were and where pools weren't. And so in that conversation, you know, I started talking also with our partners at County Parks, and it was a huge issue for them. It's been a huge issue. And so, you know, we put our heads together and we said, what can we do about this? It's a really complicated issue. It's not just a matter of let's fundraise some money and throw it at a couple pools and open them, because the issue really is lifeguards. And if you don't have enough lifeguards to open pools, you can't open pools. And so that's where we started. And the Aquatics Ambassadors came to be really as sort of like a panel of experts who could help us both understand the challenges with the lifeguard shortage and develop innovative solutions that hadn't been tried before to try and address the lifeguard crisis.
That's really interesting. So with the Aquatics Ambassadors, what did you learn or what was the feedback that you received?
Yeah, so, you know, one of the first things we did, obviously, was we tried to do a lot of outreach. Hey, have you heard about becoming a lifeguard with County Parks? You have to be 16 years old, you know, sharing the different requirements. And a lot of the feedback we were getting were folks didn't know how to swim, or maybe necessarily didn't feel like they're a part of swimming culture or feel connected to swimming in Milwaukee. And so it's hard to create a lifeguard pipeline when people don't feel safe and secure in the water. So what we did is we actually expanded the program to say, all right, we can't just look for lifeguards. We also have to talk about swimming and water safety and aquatics generally. And how do you look at the whole lifeguard pipeline from someone who might be, you know, a little nervous about the water all the way to somebody who's an expert swimmer? So really, that's the first thing we're trying to do is to raise awareness about what opportunities actually are out there to learn to swim, to get in pools, because there are a ton. And we actually have a website, aquaticsambassadorsmke.org, and our ambassadors, and Ray, I know, was really instrumental in this, pulled together just a list of all the resources available to folks who want to learn to swim, and again, regardless of where you are on the swimming and lifeguard pipeline. So that's the first piece, is really how do we raise awareness about what opportunities exist? And then the second piece I think the Aquatics Ambassadors are really focusing on is promoting equity and equitable access to swimming. Milwaukee County Parks Lifeguard Corps, just to be frank, is mostly white, young white people. And we live in a city that is made up of majority people of color. So there's clearly some folks that we're not connecting with. And how do we get creative and try to build cultures of swimming for folks who maybe don't feel as connected for a variety of reasons?
Absolutely. I know it's been a warm winter this year, but summer is still a little bit away. Why start outreach right now?
That's a great question. So there are a lot of moving parts with getting together the Lifeguard Corps, training the Lifeguard Corps. Milwaukee County Parks has incredibly rigorous standards for their lifeguards because we're talking about public pools. So, you know, people come in with a variety of swim ability. And so you have to really be prepared for all sorts of different emergencies or situations that might happen. And so they get started pretty early. They're already training folks, testing folks, and getting the lifeguard corps together so that by the time the weather's warm, you know, they're ready to go and they're ready to get out in the pools.
That's really great to hear. And that's really exciting. So I'm going to ask you, Ray.
Yeah.
Ray, I understand you first learned to swim in 2020.
Yeah.
What was your relationship to water and swimming before becoming an aquatics ambassador?
So before I became an aquatics ambassador, I really didn't have a deep connection to water. I learned how to swim because my son had to take swim lessons. And one of the requirements was, as a parent, you had to get in the water with your child because it was during the pandemic and all of these things were just like changing all the time. And so I had to get in the water with my son and just not be afraid. And he was about 10 at that time. And so I didn't want him to think that I was afraid. So I just got in and I just jumped right in and did whatever he was asked to do. And that's how I really got over my fear of water and learning how to swim.
Right. I was going to ask, what are some of the challenges or obstacles you've had to face or overcome when accessing pools or, you know, swimming?
Yeah. I think one of the big ones is just like what's like in my neighborhood, right? Like I don't have a car, so I'm always kind of looking for things that I can like walk to or bike to. And we're really fortunate to live right near North Division High School, and there's a great
pool there that's really underutilized. And so I was able to take lessons there with my son. And then I did water aerobics at one point and just kind of really love having that access right close to my house. So I can just like go get up, change and get in the water and then go home.
Yeah, like embracing this resource and now that you have it.
Yeah, and I actually love it. And I've kind of incorporated now other people in my family, like my sister's kids and my mom. My mom's taking water aerobics with me. I kind of made her join my little crew through Milwaukee Recreation Department. And so it's just, it's a lot of fun. And now I like, I have these experiences and I can go down to the beach and enjoy myself instead of just sitting in the sand.
I love that. And Elijah, I want to ask you, what inspired you or made you want to start to learn how to swim at 10?
About 4 years ago, I went to summer camp and, you know, I just hang out in the shallow end of the pool and kind of like float around by myself. And I think it was really just like curiosity and wanting to socialize with my friends since they were in the deep end. Yeah, that's what, you know, gave me the motivation to come back home and ask my mom to take me to lessons at North Division. So, yeah, we did lessons with rec and I progressed from being like a beginner to eventually joining a competitive swim team. And now I'm just kind of going through the motions of swimming for fun. And I planned on getting back into it in high school next year. So it's something I look forward to. But yeah, it became something that like went from being very intimidating and kind of scary to like a meditative experience as well as a great exercise. You know, I really enjoyed helping other people get over their fears of water too.
When you wanted to go out and learn how to swim, were you nervous about asking your mom?
I think I was more so focused on like making sure that they were comfortable in the water. And then I think we kind of helped each other along the way, like helping mom float and stuff like that. Just, you know, it was great to do that like side by side. And, you know, we both learned. And yeah, it was really rewarding in the end.
You were in it together. And what does it mean to you, Elijah, to now have these skills that you can use, you know, for the rest of your life?
Well, like, first and foremost, it is a survival skill, so I consider it a necessity for potential situations I may find myself in. I'm a Boy Scout, so it obviously come in handy with, like, you do rafting, canoeing, kayaking. One of the first badges I got is swimming, and I'll never forget that, you know, I thought it'd be so easy, but I hadn't swam in open water before. Yeah, you know, it was really interesting to kind of, like, almost be humbled by it. You found like more humility in like exploring this different body of water and kind of adapting to a different climate, stuff like that. Water may be colder. I did the plunge this year, so
wow.
That was pretty cool. Yeah, I was warned multiple times not to do it by mom. So yeah, you know, it's a survival skill. It's like safety, things like that. You can help other people through doing that. With that, I do plan on becoming a lifeguard in the next 2 or 3 years. So, yeah.
Well, Rebecca, I want to ask you, how can people become an aquatics ambassador if they're interested?
Yeah, so we're looking at what the next sort of iteration of aquatics ambassadors is going to be. We don't know what the needs are at any given moment, and all we can do is, like, listen to what people are interested in and how they want to connect to water and do our best to help, like, support that. And so the next phase of the project, I think we're really going to be looking to increase our reach and see who else is out there who is passionate about swimming, who's passionate about water, and how can they connect, and whether they're supporting financially or with their time or as an ambassador. There's so many different ways to get involved and get connected. And so I would encourage anybody who wants to learn more to go to our website, aquaticsambassadorsmke.org. We do have a form there that you can fill out and share a little bit about you. And I'll tell a cool story. We recently had a previous swimming Olympian who is local reach out to us and say, hey, I have all these connections. I love what you're doing. Let's talk. And it's those
wow.
kinds of it's those kinds of conversations and that kind of like power and resources that like when we can harness that, we can really, I think, make a significant impact and get more pools open and get more people swimming and caring about swimming.
Of course. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
One thing I was just thinking about, so I think sometimes when we talk about pools and aquatics, it can seem like a nice to have, right? Like that's so cool to splash around in a pool on a hot day. But drowning is one of the leading causes of unintentional death and injury for young people. And we call ourselves the freshwater capital, right? Like, there's so much water in Milwaukee. And so it's not a nice to have. It's a necessity. Like, we have a responsibility to all of our neighbors. As the freshwater capital, we have a responsibility to make sure we have a strong swimming and water culture. And for me personally, so my first job in high school, I was a lifeguard. I was in swim teams growing up. And I have had a variety of, like, my own mental health challenges. And swimming has been, honestly, something that has really gotten me through those. And so, it's a safety issue. It's a life and death issue. It's a mental and emotional health and wellness issue. It's a serious challenge to not have the swimming ability and the pools open that we should have in Milwaukee. So this is something that I'm really passionate about. I know Ray and Elijah are passionate about, all of our aquatics ambassadors, and a lot of our partners at County Parks are super passionate about. So I would just encourage people to think about, what's your relationship to water? How can you get connected? And how can we work collaboratively to make sure that the next generation of Milwaukeeans feel safe and secure and feel really connected to our water?
Well, Rebecca, Ray, and Elijah, thank you so much for speaking with me today and for sharing so much more with me about this impactful program.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Rebecca Stoner is the executive director of the Milwaukee Parks Foundation. Ray Johnson and Elijah Moore are mother and son and are both aquatics ambassadors for the county. They all spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn why Lake Michigan appears to be different colors. Plus, ahead of Father's Day weekend, we'll talk to some Milwaukee dads about the work they do in the community and with their kids. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.